Side 5. Disclosure by Michael Crichton. Continuing on page 189. Johnson to take operations post. Cupertino, October 20th. Meredith Johnson has been named new assistant manager for division operations in Cupertino, replacing the very popular Harry Warner, who retired after 15 years of service. The shift to ops manager takes Johnson out of marketing, where she has been very effective for the last year since joining the company. In her new position, she will work closely with Bob Garvin on international operations for Digicom. But it was the accompanying picture that caught Sanders' attention. Once again, it was a formal headshot, but Johnson now looked completely different. Her hair was light blonde. Gone was the neat business school page boy. She wore her hair short in a curly, informal style. She was wearing much less makeup and smiling cheerfully. Overall, the effect was to make her appear much more youthful, open, innocent. Sanders frowned. Quickly, he flipped back through the issues he had already looked at. Then he went back to the previous stack with its year-end Christmas pictures. Merry Christmas from the boss, ho, ho, ho. He looked at the family portrait. Garvin standing behind his three children, two sons and a daughter. That must be Jennifer. His wife, Harriet, stood to one side. In the picture, Garvin was smiling, his hand resting lightly on his daughter's shoulder, and she was tall and athletic-looking, with short, light blonde, curly hair. I'll be damned, he said aloud. He thumbed back quickly to the first article to look at the original picture of Johnson. He compared it to the later one. There was no doubt about what she had done. He read the rest of the first article. As a new arrival to Digicom, Ms. Johnson brings her considerable business acumen, her sparkling humor, and her sizzling softball pitch. She's a major addition to the Digicom team. Welcome, Meredith. Her admiring friends are never surprised to learn that Meredith was once a finalist in the Miss Teen Connecticut contest. In her student days at Vassar, Meredith was a valued member of both the tennis team and the debating society. A member of Phi Beta Kappa, she took her major in psychology with a minor in abnormal psych. Hope you won't be needing that around here, Meredith. At Stanford, she obtained her MBA with honors, graduating near the top of her class. Meredith told us, I am delighted to join Digicom, and I look forward to an exciting career with this forward-looking company. We couldn't have said it better, Ms. Johnson. No shit, Sanders said. He had known almost none of this. From the start, Meredith had been based in Cupertino. Sanders never saw her. The one time he had run into her was soon after her arrival, before she changed her hair. Her hair. And what else? He looked carefully at the two pictures. Something else was subtly different. Had she had plastic surgery? It was impossible to know. But her appearance was definitely changed between the two portraits. He moved through the remaining issues of the magazine quickly now, convinced that he had learned what there was to know. Now he skimmed only the headlines. Garvin sends Johnson to Texas for Austin plant oversight. Johnson will head new operations review unit. Johnson named Operations Veep to work directly under Garvin. Johnson, triumph in Malaysia. Labor conflict now resolved. Meredith Johnson, our rising star. A superb manager, her skill in technical areas very strong. This final headline ran above a lengthy profile of Johnson, well placed on the second page of the magazine. It had appeared in Comline only two issues ago. Seeing it now, Sanders realized that the article was intended for internal consumption, softening up the beachhead before the June landing. This article was a trial balloon that Cupertino had floated to see if Meredith would be acceptable to run the technical divisions in Seattle. The only trouble was, Sanders never saw it, and nobody had ever mentioned it to him. The article stressed the technical savvy that Johnson had acquired during her years with the company. She was quoted as saying, I began my career working in technical areas back with Novell. The technical fields have always been my first love. I'd love to go back to it. After all, strong technical innovation lies at the heart of a forward-looking company like Digicom. Any good manager here must be able to run the technical divisions. There it was. He looked at the date. May 2nd, published 6 weeks ago, which meant that the article had been written at least 2 weeks before that. As Mark Lewin had suspected, Meredith Johnson knew she was going to be the head of the Advanced Products Division at least 2 months ago, which meant in turn that Sanders had never been under consideration to become division head. He had never had a chance. It was a done deal, months ago. Sanders swore, took the articles over to the Xerox machine and copied them, then put the stacks back on the shelf and left the press office. He got on the elevator. Mark Lewin was there. Sanders said, "Hi, Mark." Lewin didn't answer. Sanders pushed the button for the ground floor. The doors closed.
"I just hope you know what the fuck you're doing," Lewin said angrily.
"I think I do.
Because you could fuck this thing up for everybody. You know that?"
"Fuck what up?"
"Just because you got your ass in the sling, it's not our problem."
"Nobody said it was."
"I don't know what's the matter with you," Lewin said. "You're late for work. You don't call me when you say you will. What is it, trouble at home? More shit with Susan?"
"This has nothing to do with Susan."
"Yeah? I think it does. You've been late 2 days running, and even when you're here, you walk around like you're dreaming. You're in fucking dreamland, Tom. I mean, what the hell were you doing? Going to Meredith's office at night, anyway?"
"She asked me to come to her office. She's the boss. You're saying I shouldn't have gone?"
Lewin shook his head in disgust. "This innocent act is a lot of crap. Don't you take any responsibility for anything?"
"What?"
"Look, Tom, everybody in the company knows that Meredith is a shark. Meredith Man-Muncher, they call her. The Great White. Everybody knows she's protected by Garvin, that she can do what she wants. And what she wants is to play grab-ass with cute guys who show up in her office at the end of the day. She has a couple of glasses of wine, she gets a little flushed, and she wants service. A delivery boy, a trainee, a young account guy, whatever. And nobody can say a word because Garvin thinks she walks on water. So how come everybody else in the company knows it but you?"
Sanders was stunned. He did not know how to answer. He stared at Lewin, who stood very close to him, his body hunched, hands in his pockets. He could feel Lewin's breath on his face, but he could hardly hear Lewin's words. It was as if they came to him from a great distance.
"Hey, Tom, you walk the same halls, you breathe the same air as the rest of us. You know who's doing what. You go marching up there to her office, and you know damned well what's coming. Meredith's done everything but announce to the world that she wants to suck your dick. All day long she's touching your arm, giving you those meaningful little looks and squeezes. Oh, Tom, so nice to see you again. And now you tell me you didn't know what was coming in that office? Fuck you, Tom. You're an asshole."
The elevator doors opened. Before them, the ground floor lobby was deserted, growing dark in the fading light of the June evening. A soft rain fell outside. Lewin started toward the exit, then turned back. His voice echoed in the lobby.
"You realize," he said, "that you're acting like one of those women in all this? The way they always go, 'Who, me? I never intended that.' The way they go, 'Oh, it's not my responsibility. I never thought if I got drunk and kissed him and went to his room and lay down on his bed that he'd fuck me. Oh, dear me, no. It's bullshit, Tom. Irresponsible bullshit. And you better think about what I'm saying, because there's a lot of us who have worked every bit as hard as you have in this company, and we don't want to see you screw up this merger and this spin-off for the rest of us. You want to pretend you can't tell when a woman's coming onto you, that's fine. You want to screw up your own life, it's your decision. But you screw up mine, and I'm going to fucking put you away."
Lewin stalked off. The elevator doors started to close. Sanders stuck his hand out. The doors closed on his fingers. He jerked his hand, and the doors opened again. He hurried out into the lobby after Lewin. He grabbed Lewin on the shoulder.
"Mark, wait, listen. I got nothing to say to you. I got kids, I got responsibilities. You're an asshole."
Lewin shrugged Sanders' arm off, pushed open the door, and walked out. He strode quickly away down the street. As the glass doors closed, Sanders saw a flash of blonde in the moving reflection. He turned.
"I thought that was a little unfair," Meredith Johnson said.
She was standing about 20 feet behind him, near the elevators. She was wearing gym clothes, navy tights and a sweatshirt, and she carried a gym bag in her hand. She looked beautiful, overtly sexual in a certain way. Sanders felt tense,
There was no one else in the lobby. They were alone.
Yes, Sanders said. I thought it was unfair.
I meant to women, Meredith said.
She swung the gym bag over her shoulder, the movement raising her sweatshirt and exposing her bare abdomen above her tights. She shook her head and pushed her hair back from her face. She paused a moment, and then she began to speak.
I want to tell you I'm sorry about all this, she said.
She moved toward him in a steady, confident way, almost stalking. Her voice was low.
I never wanted any of this, Tom.
She came a little closer, approaching slowly, as if he were an animal that might be frightened away.
I have only the warmest feelings for you.
Still closer.
Only the warmest.
Closer.
I can't help it, Tom, if I still want you.
Closer.
If I did anything to offend you, I apologize.
She was very close now, her body almost touching his, her breasts inches from his arm.
I'm truly sorry, Tom,
she said softly. She seemed filled with emotion, her breasts rising and falling, her eyes moist and pleading as she looked up at him.
Can you forgive me? Please? You know how I feel about you.
He felt all the old sensations, the old stirrings. He clenched his jaw. Meredith, the past is past. Cut it out, will you? She immediately changed her tone and gestured to the street.
Listen, I have a car here. Can I drop you somewhere?
No, thanks.
It's raining. I thought you might want a lift.
I don't think it's a good idea.
Only because it's raining.
This is Seattle, he said. It rains all the time here. She shrugged, walked to the door, and leaned her weight against it, thrusting out her hip. Then she looked back at him and smiled.
Remind me never to wear tights around you. It's embarrassing. You make me wet.
Then she turned away, pushed through the door, and walked quickly to the waiting car, getting in the back. She closed the door, looked back at him, and waved cheerfully. The car drove off. Sanders unclenched his hands. He took a deep breath and let it out slowly. His whole body was tense. He waited until the car was gone, then went outside. He felt the rain on his face, the cool evening breeze. He hailed a taxi. The Four Seasons Hotel, he said to the driver. Riding in the taxi, Sanders stared out the window, breathing deeply. He felt as though he couldn't get his breath. He had been badly unnerved by the meeting with Meredith, especially coming so close after his conversation with Lewin. Sanders was distressed by what Lewin had said, but you could never take Mark too seriously. Lewin was an artistic hothead who handled his creative tensions by getting angry. He was angry about something most of the time. Lewin liked being angry. Sanders had known him a long time. Personally, he had never understood how Adele, Mark's wife, put up with it. Adele was one of those wonderfully calm, almost phlegmatic women who could talk on the phone while her two kids crawled all over her, tugging at her, asking her questions. In a similar fashion, Adele just let Lewin rage while she went on about her business. In fact, everyone just let Lewin rage, because everyone knew that in the end, it didn't mean anything. Yet, it was also true that Lewin had a kind of instinct for public perceptions and trends. That was the secret of his success as a designer. Lewin would say, "Pastel colors," and everybody would groan and say that the new design colors looked like hell. But 2 years later, when the products were coming off the line, pastel colors would be just what everybody wanted. So Sanders was forced to admit that what Lewin had said about him, others would soon be saying. Lewin had said the company line, that Sanders was screwing up the chances for everybody else.
Well, screw them, he thought.
As for Meredith, he had had the distinct feeling that she had been toying with him in the lobby, teasing him, playing with him. He could not understand why she was so confident. Sanders was making a very serious allegation against her, yet she behaved as if there was no threat at all. She had a kind of imperviousness and indifference that made him deeply uneasy. It could only mean she knew that she had Garvin's backing. The taxi pulled into the turnaround of the hotel. He saw Meredith's car up ahead. She was talking to the driver. She looked back and saw him. There was nothing to do but get out and walk toward the entrance.
Are you following me? She said, smiling.
No.
Sure?
Yes, Meredith, I'm sure.
They went up the escalator from the street to the lobby. He stood behind her on the escalator. She looked back at him.
I wish you were.
Yeah, well, I'm not.
It would have been nice, she said.
She smiled invitingly. He didn't know what to say. He just shook his head. They rode the rest of the way in silence until they came to the high, ornate lobby.
She said, I'm in room 423. Come and see me anytime.
She headed toward the elevators. He waited until she was gone, then crossed the lobby and turned left to the dining room. Standing at the entrance, he saw Dorfman at a corner table eating dinner with Garvin and Stephanie Kaplan. Max was holding forth, gesturing sharply as he spoke. Garvin and Kaplan both leaned forward, listening. Sanders was reminded that Dorfman had once been a director of the company. According to the stories, a very powerful director. It was Dorfman who had persuaded Garvin to expand beyond modems into cellular telephony and wireless communications, back in the days when nobody could see any link between computers and telephones. The link was obvious now, but obscure in the early 1980s, when Dorfman had said, Your business is not hardware. Your business is communications. Your business is access to information. Dorfman had shaped company personnel as well. Supposedly, Kaplan owed her position to his glowing endorsement. Sanders had come to Seattle on Dorfman's recommendation. Mark Lewin had been hired because of Dorfman. And any number of vice presidents had vanished over the years because Dorfman found them lacking in vision or stamina. He was a powerful ally or a lethal opponent. And his position at the time of the merger was equally strong. Although Dorfman had resigned as a director years before, he still owned a good deal of Digicom stock, he still had Garvin's ear, and he still had the contacts and prestige within the business and financial community that made a merger like this much simpler. If Dorfman approved the terms of the merger, his admirers at Goldman Sachs and at First Boston would raise the money easily. But if Dorfman was dissatisfied, if he hinted that the merger of the two companies did not make sense, then the acquisition might unravel. Everyone knew it. Everyone understood very well the power he wielded, especially Dorfman himself. Sanders hung back at the entrance to the restaurant, reluctant to come forward. After a while, Max glanced up and saw him. Still talking, he shook his head fractionally, no. Then, as he continued to talk, he made a subtle motion with his hand, tapping his watch. Sanders nodded and went back into the lobby and sat down. He had the stack of Comline photocopies on his lap. He browsed through them, studying again the way Meredith had changed her appearance. A few minutes later, Dorfman rolled out in his wheelchair. So, Thomas, I am glad you are not bored with your life.
What does that mean?
Dorfman laughed and gestured to the dining room.
They're talking of nothing else in there. The only topic this evening is you and Meredith. Everyone is so excited, so worried.
Including Bob?
Yes, of course, including Bob.
He wheeled closer to Sanders.
I cannot really speak to you now. Was there something in particular?
I think you ought to look at this, Sanders said, handing Dorfman the photocopies.
He was thinking that Dorfman could take these pictures to Garvin. Dorfman could make Garvin understand what was really going on. Dorfman examined them in silence a moment.
Such a lovely woman, he said. So beautiful.
Look at the differences, Max. Look at what she did to herself.
Dorfman shrugged.
She changed her hair. Very flattering. So?
I think she had plastic surgery as well.
It wouldn't surprise me, Dorfman said. So many women do these days. It is like brushing their teeth to them.
It gives me the creeps.
Why? Dorfman said.
Because it's underhanded, that's why.
What's underhanded? Dorfman said, shrugging. She is resourceful. Good for her.
I'll bet Garvin has no idea what she's doing to him, Sanders said.
Dorfman shook his head.
I'm not concerned about Garvin, he said. I'm concerned about you, Thomas, and this outrage of yours. Hmm?
I'll tell you why I'm outraged, Sanders said, because this is the kind of sneaky shit that a woman can pull but a man can't. She changes her appearance, she dresses and acts like Garvin's daughter, and that gives her an advantage, because I sure as hell can't act like his daughter. Dorfman sighed, shaking his head.
Thomas, Thomas. Well, I can't, can I? Are you enjoying this? You seem to be enjoying this outrage.
I'm not.
Then give it up,
Dorfman said.
He turned his wheelchair to face Sanders.
Stop talking this nonsense and face what is true. Young people in organizations advanced by alliances with powerful senior people. True?
Yes.
And it is always so. At one time, the alliance was formal. An apprentice and master, or a pupil and tutor. It was arranged, yes? But today, it is not formal. Today we speak of mentors. Young people in business have mentors. True?
Okay.
So, how do young people attach themselves to a mentor? What is the process? First, by being agreeable, by being helpful to the senior person, doing jobs that need to be done. Second, by being attractive to the older person, imitating their attitudes and tastes. Third, by advocacy, adopting their agenda within the company.
That's all fine, Sanders said. What does it have to do with plastic surgery?
Do you remember when you joined Digicom in Cupertino?
Yes, I remember.
You came over from DEC. In 1980?
Yes.
At DEC, you wore a coat and tie every day. But when you joined Digicom, you saw that Garvin wore jeans. And soon, you wore jeans too.
Sure, that was the style of the company.
Garvin liked the Giants. You began to go to games in Candlestick Park.
He was the boss, for Christ's sake.
And Garvin liked golf, so you took up golf even though you hated it. I remember you complained to me about how much you hated it, chasing the stupid little white ball.
Listen, I didn't have plastic surgery to make myself look like his kid.
Because you didn't have to,
Thomas, Dorfman said. He threw up his hands in exasperation.
Can you not see this point? Garvin liked rash, aggressive young men who drank beer, who swore, who chased women. And you did all those things in those days.
I was young. That's what young men do.
No, Thomas. That's what Garvin liked young men to do.
Dorfman shook his head.
So much of this is unconscious. Rapport is unconscious, Thomas. But the task of building rapport is different depending on whether you are the same sex as that person or not. If your mentor is a man, you may act like his son, or brother, or father. Or you may act like that man when he was younger. You may remind him of himself. True? Yes, you see that. Good. But if you are a woman, everything is different. Now you must be your mentor's daughter, or lover, or wife, or perhaps sister. In any case, very different.
Sanders frowned.
I see this often now that men are starting to work for women. Many times men cannot structure the relationship because they do not know how to act as the subordinate to a woman, not with comfort. But in other cases, men slip easily into a role with a woman. They are the dutiful son or the substitute lover or husband. And if they do it well, the women in the organization become angry because they feel that they cannot compete as son or lover or husband to the boss. So they feel that the man has an advantage.
Sanders was silent.
Do you understand? Dorfman said.
You're saying it happens both ways.
Yes, Thomas. It is inevitable. It is the process.
Come on, Max. There's nothing inevitable about it. When Garvin's daughter died, it was a personal tragedy. He was upset. And Meredith took advantage of...
Stop, Dorfman said, annoyed. Now you want to change human nature? There are always tragedies, and people always take advantage. This is nothing new. Meredith is intelligent. It is delightful to see such an intelligent, resourceful woman who is also beautiful. She is a gift from God. She is delightful. This is your trouble, Thomas, and it has been a long time coming.
What does that...
And instead of dealing with your trouble, you waste your time with these trivialities.
He handed back the pictures.
These are not important, Thomas.
Max, will you...
You were never a good corporate player, Thomas. It was not your strength. Your strength was that you could take a technical problem and grind it down, push the technicians, encourage them and bully them, and finally get it solved. You could make it work. Is that not so?
Sanders nodded.
But now you abandon your strengths for a game that does not suit you.
Meaning what?
You think that by threatening a lawsuit, you put pressure on her and on the company. In fact, you played into her hands. You have let her define the game, Thomas.
I had to do something. She broke the law.
She broke the law. Dorfman mimicked him with a sarcastic whine. Oh me, oh my, and you are so defenseless. I am filled with sorrow for your plight.
It's not easy. She's well connected. She has strong supporters.
Is that so? Every executive with strong supporters also has strong detractors. And Meredith has her share of detractors.
I tell you, Max, Sanders said, she's dangerous. She's one of those MBA image people, focused on image, everything image, never substance.
Yes, Dorfman said, nodding approvingly. Like so many young executives today, very skilled with images, very interested in manipulating that reality. A fascinating trend.
I don't think she's competent to run this division.
And what if she is not? Dorfman snapped. What difference does it make to you? If she's incompetent, Garvin will eventually acknowledge it and replace her. But by then, you will be long gone, because you will lose this game with her, Thomas. She is better at politics than you. She always was.
Sanders nodded. She's ruthless.
Ruthless, schmoothless. She is skilled. She has an instinct. You lack it. You will lose everything if you persist this way. And you will deserve the fate that befalls you because you have behaved like a fool.
Sanders was silent. What do you recommend I do?
Ah, so now you want advice?
Yes.
Really?
He smiled.
I doubt it.
Yes, Max. I do.
All right, here is my advice. Go back, apologize to Meredith, apologize to Garvin, and resume your job.
I can't.
Then you don't want advice.
I can't do that, Max.
Too much pride?
No, but...
You are infatuated with the anger. How dare this woman act this way? She has broken the law. She must be brought to justice. She is dangerous. She must be stopped. You are filled with delicious, righteous indignation. True?
Oh, hell, Max. I just can't do it, that's all.
Of course you can do it. You mean you won't?
All right. I won't.
Dorfman shrugged.
Then what do you want from me? You come to ask my advice in order not to take it? This is nothing special.
He grinned.
I have a lot of other advice you won't take either.
Like what?
What do you care, since you won't take it?
Come on, Max.
I'm serious. You won't take it. We are wasting our time here. Go away.
Just tell me, will you?
Dorfman sighed.
Only because I remember you from the days when you had sense. First point, are you listening?
Yes, Max, I am.
First point, you know everything you need to know about Meredith Johnson. So forget her now. She is not your concern.
What does that mean?
Don't interrupt. Second point, play your own game, not hers.
Meaning what?
Meaning, solve the problem.
Solve what problem? The lawsuit?
Dorfman snorted and threw up his hands.
You are impossible. I am wasting my time.
You mean drop the lawsuit?
Can you understand English? Solve the problem. Do what you do well. Do your job. Now go away.
But Max...
Oh, I can't do anything for you, Dorfman said. It's your life. You have your own mistakes to make, and I must return to my guests. But try to pay attention, Thomas. Do not sleep through this. And remember, all human behavior has a reason. All behavior is solving a problem. Even your behavior, Thomas.
And he spun in his wheelchair and went back to the dining room.
Fucking Max, he thought, walking down Third Street in the damp evening. It was infuriating the way Max would never just say what he meant.
This is your trouble, Thomas. And it has been a long time coming.
What the hell was that supposed to mean?
Fucking Max. Infuriating and frustrating and exhausting, too.
That was what Sanders remembered most about the sessions he used to have when Max was on the Digicom board. Sanders would come away exhausted. In those days, back in Cupertino, the junior execs had called Dorfman the Riddler.
All human behavior is solving a problem. Even your behavior, Thomas.
Sanders shook his head. It made no sense at all. Meanwhile, he had things to do. At the end of the street, he stepped into a phone booth and dialed Gary Bosack's number. It was 8 o'clock. Bosack would be home, just getting out of bed and having coffee, starting his working day. Right now, he would be yawning in front of a half-dozen modems and computer screens as he began to dial into all sorts of databases. The phone rang, and a machine said, "You have reached N.E. Professional Services. Leave a message." And a beep. "Gary, this is Tom Sanders. I know you're there. Pick up." A click, and then Bosack said,
"Hey, the last person I thought I'd hear from. Where are you calling from?"
"Payphone."
"Good. How's it going with you, Tom?"
"Gary, I need some things done. Some data looked up."
Are we talking things for the company or private things?"
"Private."
"Tom, I'm pretty busy these days. Can we talk about this next week?"
"That's too late."
"But the thing is, I'm pretty busy now."
"Gary, what is this?"
"Tom, come on. You know what this is."
"I need help, Gary."
"Hey, and I'd love to help you. But I just got a call from Blackburn, who told me that if I had anything to do with you, anything at all, I could expect the FBI going through my apartment at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning."
"Christ. When was this?"
"About 2 hours ago."
2 hours ago. Blackburn was way ahead of him. "Gary."
"Hey, you know I always liked you, Tom.
But not this time.
Okay? I got to go."
Click. "Frankly, none of this surprises me," Fernandez said, pushing aside a paper plate. She and Sanders had been eating sandwiches in her office. It was 9 p.m. and the offices around them were dark, but her phone was still ringing, interrupting them frequently. Outside, it had begun to rain again. Thunder rumbled, and Sanders saw flashes of summer lightning through the windows. Sitting in the deserted law offices, Sanders had the feeling that he was all alone in the world, with nobody but Fernandez and the encroaching darkness. Things were happening quickly. This person he had never met before today was fast becoming a kind of lifeline for him. He found himself hanging on every word she said.
"Before we go on, I want to emphasize one thing," Fernandez said.
"You were right not to get in the car with Johnson. You are not to be alone with her ever again, not even for a few moments, not ever, under any circumstances. Is that clear?"
"Yes."
"If you do, it will destroy your case."
"I won't."
"All right," she said. "Now, I had a long talk with Blackburn. As you guessed, he's under tremendous pressure to get this matter resolved. I tried to move the mediation session to the afternoon. He implied that the company was ready to deal and wanted to get started right away. He's concerned about how long the negotiations will take. So we'll start at 9 tomorrow."
"Okay."
"Herb and Allen have been making progress. I think they'll be able to help us tomorrow." "And these articles about Johnson may be useful, too," she said, glancing at the photocopies of the comline pieces.
"Why? Dorfman says they're irrelevant."
"Yes, but they document her history in the company, and that gives us leads. It's something to work on. So is this email from your friend."
She frowned at the sheet of printout.
"This is an internet address."
"Yes," he said, surprised that she knew.
"We do a lot of work with high technology companies. I'll have somebody check it out."
She put it aside.
"Now, let's review where we are. You couldn't clean out your desk because they were already there."
"Right."
"And you would have cleaned out your computer files, but you've been shut out of the system."
"Yes."
"Which means that you can't change anything."
"That's right. I can't do anything. It's like I'm an assistant."
She said, "Were you going to change any files?"
He hesitated. "No, but I would have, you know, looked around."
"Nothing in particular you were aware of?"
"No."
"Mr. Sanders," she said, "I want to emphasize that I have no judgment here. I'm simply trying to prepare for what may happen tomorrow. I want to know what surprises they'll have for us."
He shook his head. "There isn't anything in the files that's embarrassing to me."
"You've thought it over carefully?"
"Yes."
Okay, she said. Then, considering the early start, I think you better get some sleep. I want you sharp tomorrow. Will you be able to sleep?
Geez, I don't know.
Take a sleeping pill if you need to.
I'll be okay.
Then go home and go to bed, Mr. Sanders. I'll see you in the morning. Wear a coat and tie tomorrow. Do you have some kind of a blue coat?
A blazer?
Fine. Wear a conservative tie and a white shirt. No aftershave.
I never dress like that at the office.
This is not the office, Mr. Sanders. That's just the point.
She stood up and shook his hand.
Get some sleep, and try not to worry. I think everything is going to be fine.
I bet you say that to all your clients.
Yes, I do, she said, but I'm usually right. Get some sleep, Tom. I'll see you tomorrow.
He came home to a dark, empty house. Eliza's Barbie dolls lay in an untidy heap on the kitchen counter. One of his son's bibs, streaked with green baby food, was on the counter beside the sink. He set up the coffee maker for the morning and went upstairs. He walked past the answering machine but neglected to look at it and failed to notice the blinking light. Upstairs, when he undressed in the bathroom, he saw that Susan had taped a note to the mirror. Sorry about lunch. I believe you. I love you. S. It was just like Susan to be angry and then to apologize. But he was glad for the note and considered calling her now. But it was nearly midnight in Phoenix, which meant it was too late. She'd be asleep. Anyway, as he thought about it, he realized that he didn't want to call her. As she had said at the restaurant, this had nothing to do with her. He was alone in this. He'd stay alone. Wearing just shorts, he padded into his little office. There were no faxes. He switched on his computer and waited while it came up. The email icon was blinking. He clicked it. Trust nobody. A friend. Sanders shut off the computer and went to bed. Wednesday. In the morning, he took comfort in his routine, dressing quickly while listening to the television news, which he turned up loud, trying to fill the empty house with noise. He drove into town at 6:30, stopping at the Bainbridge Bakery to buy a pull-apart and a cup of cappuccino before going down to the ferry. As the ferry pulled away from Winslow, he sat toward the stern so he would not have to look at Seattle as it approached. Lost in his thoughts, he stared out the window at the gray clouds hanging low over the dark water of the bay. It looked like it would rain again today.
Bad day, huh? A woman said.
He looked up and saw Mary Ann Hunter, pretty and petite, standing with her hands on her hips, looking at him with concern. Mary Ann lived on Bainbridge, too. Her husband was a marine biologist at the university. She and Susan were good friends and often jogged together. But he didn't often see Mary Ann on the ferry because she usually went in early.
Morning, Mary Ann.
What I can't understand is how they got it, she said.
Got what? Sanders said.
You mean you haven't seen it? Jesus, you're in the papers, Tom.
She handed him the newspaper under her arm.
You're kidding.
No, Connie Walsh strikes again.
Sanders looked at the front page but saw nothing. He began flipping through quickly.
It's in the Metro section, she said. The first opinion column on the second page. Read it and weep. I'll get more coffee.
She walked away. Sanders opened the paper to the Metro section. As I See It, by Constance Walsh, Mr. Piggy at Work. The power of the patriarchy has revealed itself again, this time in a local high-tech firm I'll call Company X. This company has appointed a brilliant, highly competent woman to a major executive position. But many men in the company are doing their damnedest to get rid of her. One man in particular, let's call him Mr. Piggy, has been especially vindictive. Mr. Piggy can't tolerate a woman supervisor, and for weeks he has been running a bitter campaign of innuendo inside the company to keep it from happening. When that failed, Mr. Piggy claimed that his new boss sexually assaulted him and nearly raped him in her offices. The blatant hostility of this claim is matched only by its absurdity. Some of you may wonder how a woman could rape a man. The answer is, of course, she can't. Rape is a crime of violence. It is exclusively a crime of males who use rape with appalling frequency to keep women in their place. That is the deep truth of our society and of all other societies before ours. For their part, women simply do not oppress men.
Women are powerless in the hands of men. And to claim that a woman committed rape is absurd. But that didn't stop Mr. Piggy, who was interested only in smearing his new supervisor. He's even bringing a formal charge of sexual harassment against her. In short, Mr. Piggy has the nasty habits of a typical patriarch. As you might expect, they appear everywhere in his life. Although Mr. Piggy's wife is an outstanding attorney, he pressures her to give up her job and stay home with the kids. After all, Mr. Piggy doesn't want his wife out in the business world, where she might hear about his affairs with young women and his excessive drinking. He probably figures his new female supervisor wouldn't approve of that either. Maybe she won't allow him to be late to work, as he so often is. So Mr. Piggy has made his underhanded move, and another talented businesswoman sees her career unfairly jeopardized. Will she be able to keep the pigs in the pen at Company X? Stay tuned for updates. Christ, Sanders said. He read it through again. Hunter came back with two cappuccinos in paper cups. She pushed one toward him.
Here, looks like you need it.
How did they get the story? He said.
Hunter shook her head.
I don't know. It looks to me like there's a leak inside the company. But who? Sanders was thinking that if the story made the paper, it must have been leaked by 3 or 4 p.m. the day before. Who in the company even knew that he was considering a harassment charge at that time?
I can't imagine who it could be, Hunter said. I'll ask around.
And who's Constance Walsh?
You never read her? She's a regular columnist at the Post-Intelligencer, Hunter said. Feminist perspectives, that kind of thing.
She shook her head.
How is Susan? I tried to call her this morning, and there's no answer at your house.
Susan's gone away for a few days with the kids. Hunter nodded slowly.
That's probably a good idea.
We thought so.
She knows about this?
Yes.
And is it true? Are you charging harassment?
Yes.
Jesus.
Yes, he said, nodding. She sat with him for a long time, not speaking. She just sat with him. Finally, she said,
I've known you for a long time. I hope this turns out okay.
Me too. There was another long silence. Finally, she pushed away from the table and got up.
See you later, Tom.
See you, Marianne. He knew what she was feeling. He had felt it himself when others in the company had been accused of harassment. There was suddenly a distance. It didn't matter how long you had known the person. It didn't matter if you were friends. Once an accusation was made, everybody pulled away. Because the truth was, you never knew what had happened. You couldn't afford to take sides, even with your friends. He watched her walk away, a slender, compact figure in exercise clothes, carrying a leather briefcase. She was barely 5 feet tall. The men on the ferry were so much larger. He remembered that she had once told Susan that she took up running because of her fear of rape.
I'll just outrun them, she had said.
Men didn't know anything about that. They didn't understand that fear. But there was another kind of fear that only men felt. He looked at the newspaper column with deep and growing unease. Key words and phrases jumped out at him. Vindictive. Bitter. Can't tolerate a woman. Blatant hostility. Rape. Crime of males. Smearing his supervisor. Affairs with young women. Excessive drinking. Late to work. Unfairly jeopardized. Pigs in the pen. These characterizations were more than inaccurate, more than unpleasant. They were dangerous. And it was exemplified by what happened to John Masters, a story that had reverberated among many senior men in Seattle. Masters was 50, a marketing manager at MicroSim. A stable guy, solid citizen, married 25 years, two kids, the older girl in college, the younger girl a junior in high school. The younger girl starts to have trouble with school. Her grades go down, so the parents send her to a child psychologist. The child psychologist listens to the daughter and then says,
You know, this is the typical story of an abused child. Do you have anything like that in your past?
Gee, the girl says, I don't think so.
Think back, the psychologist says.
At first, the girl resists, but the psychologist keeps at her. Think back. Try to remember. And after a while, the girl starts to recall some vague memories. Nothing specific, but now she thinks it's possible. Maybe Daddy did do something wrong way back then. The psychologist tells the wife what is suspected. After 25 years together, the wife and Masters have some anger between them. The wife goes to Masters and says, "Admit what you did." Masters is thunderstruck. He can't believe it. He denies everything. The wife says, "You're lying. I don't want you around here." She makes him move out of the house. The older daughter flies home from college. She says, "What is this madness? You know Daddy didn't do anything. Come to your senses." But the wife is angry. The daughter is angry. And the process, once set in motion, can't be stopped. The psychologist is required by state law to report any suspected abuse. She reports Masters to the state. The state is required by law to conduct an investigation. Now a social worker is talking to the daughter, the wife, and Masters. Then to the family doctor, the school nurse. Pretty soon everybody knows. Word of the accusation gets to MicroSim. The company suspends him from his job, pending the outcome. They say they don't want negative publicity. Masters is seeing his life dissolve. His younger daughter won't talk to him. His wife won't talk to him. He's living alone in an apartment. He has money problems. Business associates avoid him. Everywhere he turns, he sees accusing faces. He is advised to get a lawyer. And he is so shattered, so uncertain, he starts going to a shrink himself. His lawyer makes inquiries. Disturbing details emerge. It turns out that the particular psychologist who made the accusation uncovers abuse in a high percentage of her cases. She has reported so many cases that the state agency has begun to suspect bias. But the agency can do nothing. The law requires that all cases be investigated. The social worker assigned to the case has been previously disciplined for her excessive zeal in pursuing questionable cases and is widely thought to be incompetent, but the state cannot fire her for the usual reasons. The specific accusation, never formally presented, turns out to be that Masters molested his daughter in the summer of her third grade. Masters thinks back, has an idea. He gets his old canceled checks out of storage, digs up his old business calendars. It turns out that his daughter was at camp in Montana that whole summer. When she came home in August, Masters was on a business trip in Germany. He did not return from Germany until after school had started again. He had never even seen his daughter that summer. Masters's shrink finds it significant that his daughter would locate the abuse at the one time when abuse was impossible. The shrink concludes that the daughter felt abandoned, and has translated that into a memory of abuse. Masters confronts the wife and daughter. They listen to the evidence and admit that they must have the date wrong, but remain adamant that the abuse occurred. Nevertheless, the facts about the summer schedule lead the state to drop its investigation, and MicroSim reinstates Masters. But Masters has missed a round of promotions, and a vague cloud of prejudice hangs over him. His career has been irrevocably damaged. His wife never reconciles, eventually filing for divorce. He never again sees his younger daughter. His older daughter, caught between warring family factions, sees less of him as time goes on. Masters lives alone, struggles to rebuild his life, and suffers a near-fatal heart attack. After his recovery, he sees a few friends, but now he is morose and drinks too much, a poor companion. Other men avoid him. No one has an answer to his constant question. What did I do wrong? What should I have done instead? How could I have prevented this? Because, of course, he could not have prevented it. Not in a contemporary climate where men were assumed to be guilty of anything they were accused of. Among themselves, men sometimes talked of suing women for false accusations. They talked of penalties for damage caused by those accusations. But that was just talk. Meanwhile, they all changed their behavior. There were new rules now, and every man knew them. Don't smile at a child on the street unless you're with your wife. Don't ever touch a strange child. Don't ever be alone with someone else's child, even for a moment. If a child invites you into his or her room, don't go unless another adult, preferably a woman, is also present. At a party, don't let a little girl sit on your lap.
If she tries, gently push her aside. If you ever have occasion to see a naked boy or girl, look quickly away. Better yet, leave. And it was prudent to be careful around your own children, too, because if your marriage went sour, your wife might accuse you. And then your past conduct would be reviewed in an unfavorable light. Well, he was such an affectionate father, perhaps a little too affectionate. Or, he spent so much time with the kids, he was always hanging around the house. This was a world of regulations and penalties entirely unknown to women. If Susan saw a child crying on the street, she picked the kid up. She did it automatically, without thinking. Sanders would never dare. Not these days. And, of course, there were new rules for business as well. Sanders knew men who would not take a business trip with a woman, who would not sit next to a female colleague on an airplane, who would not meet a woman for a drink in a bar unless someone else was also present. Sanders had always thought such caution was extreme, even paranoid. But now, he was not so sure. The sound of the ferry horn roused Sanders from his thoughts. He looked up and saw the black pilings of the Coleman dock. The clouds were still dark, still threatening rain. He stood, belted his raincoat, and headed downstairs to his car. On his way to the mediation center, he stopped by his office for a few minutes to pick up background documentation on the Twinkle Drive. He thought it might be necessary in the morning's work. But he was surprised to see John Conley in his office talking with Cindy. It was 8:15 in the morning.
"Oh, Tom," Conley said, "I was just trying to arrange an appointment with you. Cindy tells me that you have a very busy schedule and may be out of the office most of the day."
Sanders looked at Cindy. Her face was tight. "Yes," he said, "at least for the morning."
"Well, I only need a few minutes."
Sanders waved him into the office. Conley went in, and Sanders closed the door.
"I'm looking forward to the briefing tomorrow for John Martin, our CEO," Conley said. "I gather you'll be speaking then."
Sanders nodded vaguely. He had heard nothing about a briefing, and tomorrow seemed very far away. He was having trouble concentrating on what Conley was saying.
"But of course we'll all be asked to take a position on some of these agenda items," Conley said, "and I'm particularly concerned about Austin."
"Austin?"
"I mean the sale of the Austin facility."
"I see," Sanders said. So it was true.
"As you know, Meredith Johnson has taken an early and strong position in favor of the sale," Conley said. "It was one of the first recommendations she gave us in the early stages of shaping this deal. Martin's worried about cash flow after the acquisition. The deal's going to add debt. And he's worried about funding high-tech development. Johnson thought we could ease the debt load by selling off Austin. But I don't feel myself competent to judge the pros and cons on this. I was wondering what your view was."
"On a sale of the Austin plant?"
"Yes. Apparently there's tentative interest from both Hitachi and Motorola. So it's quite possible that it could be liquidated quickly. I think that's what Meredith has in mind. Has she discussed it with you?"
"No," Sanders said.
"She probably has a lot of ground to cover settling into her new job," Conley said.
He was watching Sanders carefully as he spoke.
"What do you think about a sale?"
Sanders said, "I don't see a compelling reason for it."
"Apart from cash flow issues, I think her argument is that manufacturing cellular phones has become a mature business," Conley said. "As a technology, it's gone through its exponential growth phase, and it's now approaching a commodity. The high profits are gone. From now on, there will be only incremental sales increases against increasing severe foreign competition. So telephones aren't likely to represent a major income source in the future. And, of course, there's the question of whether we should be manufacturing in the States at all. A lot of Digicom's manufacturing is already offshore."
"That's all true," Sanders said, "but it's beside the point. First of all, cellular phones may be reaching market saturation, but the general field of wireless communications is still in its infancy. We're going to see more and more wireless office nets and wireless field links in the future. So the market is still expanding, even if telephony is not. Second, I would argue that wireless is a major part of our company's future interest, and one way to stay competitive is to continue to make products and sell them.
that forces you to maintain contact with your customer base, to keep knowledgeable about their future interests. I wouldn't opt out now. If Motorola and Hitachi see a business there, why don't we? Third, I think that we have an obligation, a social obligation, if you will, to keep high-paying, skilled jobs in the U.S. Other countries don't export good jobs. Why should we? Each of our offshore manufacturing decisions has been made for a specific reason, and personally, I hope we start to move them back here, because there are many hidden costs in offshore fabrication. But most important of all, even though we are primarily a development unit here, making new products, we need manufacturing. If there's anything that the last 20 years has shown us, it's that design and manufacturing are all one process. You start splitting off the design engineers from the manufacturing guys, and you'll end up with bad design. You'll end up with General Motors. He paused. There was a brief silence. Sanders hadn't intended to speak so strongly. It just came out. But Conley just nodded thoughtfully. So you believe selling Austin would hurt the development unit? No question about it. In the end, manufacturing is a discipline. Conley shifted in his seat. How do you think Meredith Johnson feels on these issues? I don't know. Because, you see, all this raises a related question, Conley said, having to do with executive judgment. To be frank, I've heard some rumblings in the division about her appointment, in terms of whether she really has a good enough grasp on the issues to run a technical division. Sanders spread his hands. I don't feel I can say anything. I'm not asking you to, Conley said. I gather she has Garvin's support. Yes, she does. And that's fine with us. But you know what I'm driving at, Conley said. The classic problem in acquisitions is that the acquiring company doesn't really understand what they are buying, and they kill the goose that lays the golden egg. They don't intend to, but they do. They destroy the very thing they want to acquire. I'm concerned that Conley White not make a mistake like that. Uh-huh. Just between us, if this issue comes up in the meeting tomorrow, would you take the position you just took? Against Johnson? Sanders shrugged. That could be difficult. He was thinking that he probably wouldn't be at the meeting tomorrow, but he couldn't say that to Conley. Well, Conley extended his hand. Thanks for your candor. I appreciate it. He turned to go. One last thing. It'd be very helpful if we had a handle on the Twinkle Drive problem by tomorrow. I know it, Sanders said. Believe me, we're working on it. Good. Conley turned and left. Cindy came in. How are you today? Nervous. What you need me to do? Pull the data on the Twinkle Drives. I want copies of everything I took Meredith Monday night. It's on your desk. He scooped up a stack of folders. On top was a small DAT cartridge. What's this? That's your video link with Arthur from Monday. He shrugged and dropped it in his briefcase. Cindy said, Anything else? No. He glanced at his watch. I'm late. Good luck, Tom, she said. He thanked her and left the office. Driving in morning rush hour traffic, Sanders realized that the only surprise in his encounter with Conley was how sharp the young lawyer was. As for Meredith, her behavior didn't surprise him at all. For years, Sanders had fought the B-school mentality that she exemplified. After watching these graduates come and go, Sanders had finally concluded that there was a fundamental flaw in their education. They had been trained to believe that they were equipped to manage anything. But there was no such thing as general managerial skills and tools. In the end, there were only specific problems involving specific industries and specific workers. To apply general tools to specific problems was to fail. You needed to know the market. You needed to know the customers. You needed to know the limits of manufacturing and the limits of your own creative people. None of that was obvious. Meredith couldn't see that Don Cherry and Mark Lewin needed a link to manufacturing. Yet, time and again, Sanders had been shown a prototype and had asked the one significant question. It looks fine, but can you make it on a production line? Can you build it, reliably and quickly, for a price?
Sometimes they could, and sometimes they couldn't. If you took away that question, you changed the entire organization, and not for the better. Conley was smart enough to see that, and smart enough to keep his ear to the ground. Sanders wondered how much Conley knew of what he hadn't said in their meeting. Did he also know about the harassment suit? It was certainly possible. Christ, Meredith wanted to sell Austin. Eddie had been right all along. He considered telling him, but he really couldn't. And in any case, he had more pressing things to worry about. He saw the sign for the Magnuson Mediation Center and turned right. Sanders tugged at the knot on his tie and pulled into a space in the parking lot. The Magnuson Mediation Center was located just outside Seattle on a hill overlooking the city. It consisted of three low buildings arranged around a central courtyard where water splashed in fountains and pools. The entire atmosphere was designed to be peaceful and relaxing, but Sanders was tense when he walked up from the parking lot and found Fernandez pacing.
"You see the paper today?" she said.
"Yeah, I saw it."
"Don't let it upset you. This is a very bad tactical move on their part," she said. "You know Connie Walsh?"
"No."
"She's a bitch," Fernandez said briskly. "Very unpleasant and very capable. But I expect Judge Murphy to take a strong position on it in the sessions. Now, this is what I worked out with Phil Blackburn. We'll begin with your version of the events of Monday night. Then Johnson will tell hers."
"Wait a minute. Why should I go first?" Sanders said. "If I go first, she'll have the advantage of hearing..."
"You are the one bringing the claim, so you are obligated to present your case first. I think it will be to our advantage," Fernandez said. "This way Johnson will testify last, before lunch."
They started toward the center building.
"Now, there are just two things you have to remember. First, always tell the truth. No matter what happens, just tell the truth. Exactly as you remember it, even if you think it hurts your case. Okay?"
"Okay."
"Second, don't get mad. Her lawyer will try to make you angry and trap you. Don't fall for it. If you feel insulted or start to get mad, request a 5-minute break to consult with me. You're entitled to do that whenever you want. We'll go outside and cool off, but whatever you do, keep cool, Mr. Sanders."
"Okay."
"Good."
She swung open the door.
"Now, let's go do it."
The mediation room was wood-paneled and spare. He saw a polished wooden table with a pitcher of water and glasses and some notepads. In the corner, a sideboard with coffee and a plate of pastries. Windows opened out on a small atrium with a fountain. He heard the sound of soft gurgling water. The Digicom legal team was already there, ranged along one side of the table. Phil Blackburn, Meredith Johnson, an attorney named Ben Heller, and two other grim-faced female attorneys. Each woman had an imposing stack of Xeroxed papers before her on the table. Fernandez introduced herself to Meredith Johnson, and the two women shook hands. Then Ben Heller shook hands with Sanders. Heller was a florid, beefy man with silver hair and a deep voice. Well-connected in Seattle, he reminded Sanders of a politician. Heller introduced the other women, but Sanders immediately forgot their names. Meredith said,
"Hello, Tom."
"Meredith." He was struck by how beautiful she looked. She wore a blue suit with a cream-colored blouse. With her glasses and her blonde hair pulled back, she looked like a lovely but studious schoolgirl. Heller patted her hand reassuringly, as if speaking to Sanders had been a terrible ordeal. Sanders and Fernandez sat down opposite Johnson and Heller. Everybody got out papers and notes. Then there was an awkward silence until Heller said to Fernandez, "How'd that King Power thing turn out?"
"We were pleased," Fernandez said.
"They fixed an award yet?"
"Next week, Ben."
"What are you asking?"
$2 million.
$2 million?
"Sexual harassment's serious business, Ben. Awards are going up fast. Right now the average verdict is over $1 million, especially when the company behaves that badly."
At the far end of the room, a door opened and a woman in her mid-50s entered. She was brisk and erect and wore a dark blue suit not very different from Meredith's.
"Good morning," she said. "I'm Barbara Murphy. Please refer to me as Judge Murphy or Ms. Murphy."
She moved around the room, shaking hands with everyone, then took a seat at the head of the table. She opened her briefcase and took out her notes.
Let me tell you the ground rules for our sessions here, Judge Murphy said. This is not a court of law, and our proceedings won't be recorded. I encourage everyone to maintain a civil and courteous tone. We're not here to make wild accusations or to fix blame. Our goal is to define the nature of the dispute between the parties and to determine how best to resolve that dispute. I want to remind everyone that the allegations made on both sides are extremely serious and may have legal consequences for all parties. I urge you to treat these sessions confidentially. I particularly caution you against discussing what is said here with any outside person or with the press. I have taken the liberty of speaking privately to Mr. Donadio, the editor of the Post-Intelligencer, about the article that appeared today by Ms. Walsh. I reminded Mr. Donadio that all parties in Company X are private individuals and that Ms. Walsh is a paid employee of the paper. The risk of a defamation suit against the PI is very real. Mr. Donadio seemed to take my point. She leaned forward, resting her elbows on the table. Now then, the parties have agreed that Mr. Sanders will speak first, and he will then be questioned by Mr. Heller. Ms. Johnson will speak next, and will be questioned by Ms. Fernandez. In the interest of time, I alone will have the right to ask questions during the testimony of the principals, and I will set limits on the questions of opposing attorneys. I am open to some discussion, but I ask your cooperation in letting me exercise judgment and keep things moving. Before we begin, does anybody have any questions? Nobody did. All right, then let's get started. Mr. Sanders, why don't you tell us what happened, from your point of view? Sanders talked quietly for the next half hour. He began with his meeting with Blackburn, where he learned that Meredith was going to be the new vice president. He reported the conversation with Meredith after her speech, in which she suggested a meeting about the Twinkle Drive. He told what happened in the 6 o'clock meeting in detail. As he spoke, he realized why Fernandez had insisted he tell this story over and over the day before. The flow of events came easily to him now. He found that he could talk about penises and vaginas without hesitation. Even so, it was an ordeal. He felt exhausted by the time he described leaving the room and seeing the cleaning woman outside. He then told about the phone call to his wife and the early meeting the next morning, his subsequent conversation with Blackburn, and his decision to press charges. That's about it, he finished. Judge Murphy said, I have some questions before we go on. Mr. Sanders, you mentioned that wine was drunk during the meeting.
Yes.
How much wine would you say you had?
Less than a glass.
And Ms. Johnson?
How much would you say?
At least 3 glasses.
All right.
She made a note. Mr. Sanders, do you have an employment contract with the company?
Yes.
What is your understanding of what the contract says about transferring you or firing you?
They can't fire me without cause, Sanders said. I don't know what it says about transfers, but my point is that by transferring me, they might as well be firing me.
I understand your point, Murphy said, interrupting him. I'm asking about your contract. Mr. Blackburn?
Blackburn said, The relevant clause refers to equivalent transfer.
I see. So it is arguable. Fine. Let's go on. Mr. Heller, your questions for Mr. Sanders, please.
Ben Heller shuffled his papers and cleared his throat. Mr. Sanders, would you like a break?
No, I'm fine.
All right. Now, Mr. Sanders, you mentioned that when Mr. Blackburn told you on Monday morning that Ms. Johnson was going to be the new head of the division, you were surprised.
Yes.
Who did you think the new head would be?
I didn't know. Actually, I thought I might be in line for it.
Why did you think that?
I just assumed it.
Did anybody in the company, Mr. Blackburn or anybody else, lead you to think you were going to get the job?
No.
Was there anything in writing to suggest you would get the job?
No.
So when you say you assumed it, you were drawing a conclusion based on the general situation at the company, as you saw it?
Yes.
But not based on any real evidence?
No.
All right. Now, you've said that when Mr. Blackburn told you that Ms. Johnson was going to get the job, he also told you that she could choose new division heads if she wanted,
And you told him you interpreted that to mean Ms. Johnson had the power to fire you?
Yes, that's what he said.
Did he characterize it in any way? For example, did he say it was likely or unlikely?
He said it was unlikely.
And did you believe him?
I wasn't sure what to believe at that point.
Is Mr. Blackburn's judgment on company matters reliable?
Ordinarily, yes.
But in any case, Mr. Blackburn did say that Ms. Johnson had the right to fire you.
Yes.
Did Ms. Johnson ever say anything like that to you?
No.
She never made any statement that could be interpreted as an offer contingent upon your performance, including sexual performance?
No.
So when you say that during your meeting with her you felt that your job was at risk, that was not because of anything Ms. Johnson actually said or did?
No, Sanders said. But it was in the situation.
You perceived it as being in the situation?
Yes.
As you had earlier perceived that you were in line for a promotion, when in fact you were not? The very promotion that Ms. Johnson ended up getting?
I don't follow you.
I'm merely observing, Heller said, that perceptions are subjective and do not have the weight of fact.
Objection, Fernandez said. Employee perceptions have been held valid in contexts where the reasonable expectation.
Miss Fernandez, Murphy said, Mr. Heller hasn't challenged the validity of your client's perceptions. He has questioned their accuracy.
But surely they are accurate, because Ms. Johnson was his superior, and she could fire him if she wanted to.
That's not in dispute. But Mr. Heller is asking whether Mr. Sanders has a tendency to build up unjustified expectations. And that seems to me entirely relevant.
But with all due respect, Your Honor.
Ms. Fernandez, Murphy said, we're here to clarify this dispute. I'm going to let Mr. Heller continue. Mr. Heller? Thank you, Your Honor. So to summarize, Mr. Sanders, although you felt your job was on the line, you never got that sense from Ms. Johnson?
No, I didn't.
Or from Mr. Blackburn?
No.
Or, in fact, from anyone else?
No.
All right, let's turn to something else. How did it happen that there was wine at the 6 o'clock meeting?
Ms. Johnson said that she would get a bottle of wine.
You didn't ask her to do that?
No, she volunteered to do it.
And what was your reaction?
I don't know.
He shrugged.
Nothing in particular.
Were you pleased?
I didn't think about it one way or the other.
Let me put it a different way, Mr. Sanders. When you heard that an attractive woman like Miss Johnson was planning to have a drink with you after work, what went through your head?
I thought I'd better do it. She's my boss.
That's all you thought?
Yes.
Did you mention to anyone that you wanted to be alone with Ms. Johnson in a romantic setting?
Sanders sat forward, surprised. No.
Are you sure about that?
Yes.
Sanders shook his head.
I don't know what you're driving at.
Isn't Ms. Johnson your former lover?
Yes.
And didn't you want to resume your intimate relationship?
No, I did not. I was just hoping we would be able to find some way to be able to work together.
Is that difficult? I would have thought it'd be quite easy to work together since you knew each other so well in the past.
Well, it's not. It's quite awkward.
Is it? Why is that?
Well, it just is. I had never actually worked with her. I knew her in a totally different context, and I just felt awkward.
How did your prior relationship with Ms. Johnson end, Mr. Sanders?
We just sort of drifted apart.
You had been living together at the time?
Yes, and we had our normal ups and downs, and finally it just didn't work out, so we split up.
No hard feelings?
No.
Who left whom?
It was sort of mutual, as I recall.
Whose idea was it to move out?
I guess. I don't really remember. I guess it was mine.
So there was no awkwardness or tension about how the affair ended 10 years ago?
No.
And yet you felt there was awkwardness now?
Sure, Sanders said, because we had one kind of relationship in the past, and now we were going to have another kind of relationship.
You mean, now Miss Johnson was going to be your superior?
Yes.
Weren't you angry about that? About her appointment?
A little, I guess.
Only a little? Or perhaps more than a little?
Fernandez sat forward and started to protest. Murphy shot her a warning look. Fernandez put her fists under her chin and said nothing.
I was a lot of things, Sanders said. I was angry and disappointed and confused and worried.
So, in your mind, although you were feeling many different and confusing feelings, you're certain that you did not, under any circumstances, contemplate having sex with Ms. Johnson that night?
No.
It never crossed your mind?
No.
There was a pause. Heller shuffled his notes, then looked up.
You're married. Now you're not, Mr. Sanders.
Yes, I am.
Did you call your wife to tell her you had a late meeting?
Yes.
Did you tell her with whom?
No.
Why not?
My wife is sometimes jealous about my past relationships. I didn't see any reason to cause her anxiety or make her upset.
You mean, if you told her you were having a late meeting with Ms. Johnson, your wife might think that you would renew your sexual acquaintance?
I don't know what she would think, Sanders said.
But in any case, you didn't tell her about Ms. Johnson.
No.
What did you tell her?
I told her I had a meeting and I would be home late.
How late?
I told her it might run to dinner or after.
I see. Had Ms. Johnson suggested dinner to you?
No.
So you presumed, when you called your wife, that your meeting with Ms. Johnson might be a long one?
No, Sanders said. I didn't. But I didn't know exactly how long it would be. And my wife doesn't like me to call once and say I'll be an hour late, and then call again to say it'll be 2 hours. That annoys her. So it's easier for her if I just tell her I may be home after dinner. That way she doesn't expect me and doesn't wait for me. And if I get home early, it's great.
So this is your usual policy with your wife?
Yes.
Nothing unusual?
No.
In other words, your usual procedure is to lie to your wife about events at the office because, in your view, she can't take the truth.
Objection, Fernandez said. What's the relevance?
That's not it at all, Sanders continued angrily. How is it, Mr. Sanders?
Look, every marriage has its own way to work things out. This is ours. It makes things smoother, that's all. It's about scheduling at home, not about lying.
But wouldn't you say that you lied when you failed to tell your wife you were seeing Ms. Johnson that night?
Objection, Fernandez said.
Murphy said, I think this is quite enough, Mr. Heller. Your Honor, I'm trying to show that Mr. Sanders intended to consummate an encounter with Ms. Johnson, and that all his behavior is consistent with that, and in addition, to show that he routinely treats women with contempt.
You haven't shown that. You haven't even laid a groundwork for that, Murphy said.
Mr. Sanders has explained his reasons, and in the absence of contrary evidence, I accept them. Do you have contrary evidence?
No, Your Honor.
Very well. Bear in mind that inflammatory and unsubstantiated characterizations do not assist our mutual efforts at resolution.
Yes, Your Honor.
I want everyone here to be clear. These proceedings are potentially damaging to all parties, not only in their outcome, but in the conduct of the proceedings themselves. Depending on the outcome, Ms. Johnson and Mr. Sanders may find themselves working together in some capacity in the future. I will not permit these proceedings to unnecessarily poison such future relationships. Any further unwarranted accusations will cause me to halt these proceedings. Does anyone have any questions about what I've just said?
No one did.
All right. Mr. Heller?
Heller sat back.
No further questions, Your Honor.
All right, Judge Murphy said. We'll break for 5 minutes and return to hear Ms. Johnson's version.
You're doing fine, Fernandez said. You're doing very well. Your voice was strong, you were clear and even. Murphy was impressed. You're doing fine.
They were standing outside by the fountains in the courtyard. Sanders felt like a boxer between rounds, being worked over by his trainer.
How do you feel?
She asked.
Tired?
A little, not too bad.
You want coffee?
No, I'm okay.
Good, because the hard part is coming up. You're going to have to be very strong when she gives her version.
You won't like what she says. But it's important that you stay calm.
Okay.
She put her hand on his shoulder. By the way, just between us, how did the relationship end?
To tell the truth, I can't remember exactly.
Fernandez looked skeptical. But this was important, surely.
It was almost 10 years ago, Sanders said. To me, it feels like another lifetime.
She was still skeptical. Look, Sanders said, this is the third week in June. What was going on in your love life the third week of June 10 years ago? Can you tell me? Fernandez was silent, frowning.
Were you married? Sanders prompted.
No.
Met your husband yet?
Let's see. No, not until... I must have met my husband. About a year later.
Okay. Do you remember who you were seeing before him?
Fernandez was silent, thinking.
How about anything that happened between you and a lover in June 10 years ago?
She was still silent.
See what I mean? Sanders said. 10 years is a long time. I remember the affair with Meredith, but I'm not clear about the last few weeks of it. I don't remember the details of how it ended.
What do you remember?
He shrugged. We had more fights, more yelling. We were still living together, but somehow we began to arrange our schedules so that we never saw each other. You know how that happens, because when we did run into each other, we fought. And finally, one night, we had a big argument while we were getting dressed to go to a party. Some formal party for Digicom. I remember I had to wear a tux. I threw my cufflinks at her, and then I couldn't find them. I had to get down on the floor and look. But once we were driving to the party, we sort of calmed down, and we started talking about breaking up. In this very ordinary way. Very reasonable way. It just came out, both of us. Nobody shouted. And in the end, we decided it was best if we broke it off. Fernandez was looking at him thoughtfully.
That's it?
Yeah.
He shrugged.
Except we never got to the party.
Something at the back of his mind. A couple in a car, going to a party. Something about a cellular phone. All dressed up, going to the party, and they make a call, and...
He couldn't get it. It hung in his memory just beyond recollection.
The woman made a call on the cellular phone, and then...
Something embarrassing afterward.
Tom, Fernandez said, shaking his shoulder. Looks like our time is about up. Ready to go back?
I'm ready, he said.
As they were heading back to the mediation room, Heller came over. He gave Sanders an oily smile, then turned to Fernandez.
Counselor, he said, I wonder if this is the time to talk about settlement.
Settlement? Fernandez said, showing elaborate surprise. Why?
Well, things aren't going so well for your client, and...
Things are going fine for my client.
And this whole inquiry will only get more embarrassing and awkward for him the longer it continues.
My client isn't embarrassed at all.
And perhaps it is to everyone's advantage to end it now.
Fernandez smiled. I don't think that's my client's wish, Ben. But if you have an offer to make, we will, of course, entertain it.
Yes, I have an offer.
All right.
Heller cleared his throat. Considering Tom's current compensation base... and associated benefits package, and taking into consideration his lengthy service with the company, we're prepared to settle for an amount equal to several years of compensation. We'll add an allowance for your fees and other miscellaneous expenses of termination, the cost of a headhunter to relocate a new position, and all direct costs that may be associated with moving his household, and altogether make it $400,000. I think that's very generous.
I'll see what my client says, Fernandez said.
She took Sanders by the arm and walked a short distance away.
Well?
No, Sanders said.
Not so fast, she said. That's a pretty reasonable offer. It's as much as you're likely to get in court, without the delay and expenses.
No.
Want to counter?
No.
Fuck him. I think we should counter.
Fuck him.
Fernandez shook her head. Let's be smart, not angry.
What do you hope to gain from all this, Tom? There must be a figure you would accept.
I want what I'll get when they take the company public, Sanders said, and that's somewhere between 5 and 12 million.
You think it's a speculative estimate for a future event?
That's what it'll be, believe me.
Fernandez looked at him. Would you take 5 million now?
Yes.
Alternatively, would you take the compensation package he outlined, plus the stock options you would get at the time of the offering?
Sanders considered that.
Yes.
All right, I'll tell him.
She walked back across the courtyard to Heller. The two spoke briefly. After a moment, Heller turned on his heel and stalked away. Fernandez came back, grinning.
He didn't go for it.
They headed back inside.
But I'll tell you one thing. This is a good sign.
It is?
Yes, if they want to settle before Johnson gives her testimony, it's a very good sign.
In view of the acquisition, Meredith Johnson said, I felt it was important that I meet with all the division heads on Monday. She spoke calmly and slowly, looking at everyone seated around the table in turn. Sanders had the sense of an executive giving a presentation. I met with Don Cherry, Mark Lewin, and Marianne Hunter during the afternoon, but Tom Sanders said he had a very busy schedule and asked if we could meet at the end of the day. At his request, I scheduled a meeting with Tom at 6 o'clock. He was amazed at the cool way that she lied. He had expected her to be effective, but he was still astonished to see her in action. Tom suggested that we could have a drink as well and go over old times. That wasn't really my style, but I agreed. I was especially concerned to establish good relations with Tom because I knew he was disappointed he had not gotten the job, and because we had a past history. I wanted our working relationship to be cordial. For me to refuse a drink with him seemed, I don't know, standoffish or stiff. So I said yes. Tom came to the office at 6 o'clock. We had a glass of wine and talked about the problems with the Twinkle Drive. However, from the outset, he kept making comments of a personal nature that I considered inappropriate. For example, comments about my appearance, and about how often he thought about our past relationship, reference to sexual incidents in the past, and so on.
Son of a bitch.
Sanders's whole body was tense. His hands were clenched, his jaw was tight. Fernandez leaned over and put her hand on his wrist. Meredith Johnson was saying,
Had some calls from Garvin and others. I took them at my desk. Then my assistant came in and asked if she could leave early to deal with some personal matters. I said she could. She left the room. That was when Tom came over and suddenly started kissing me.
She paused for a moment, looking around the room. She met Sanders' eyes with a steady gaze.
I was taken aback by his sudden and unexpected overture, she said, staring evenly at him. At first I tried to protest and to defuse the situation. But Tom is much larger than I am, much stronger. He pulled me over onto the couch and started to disrobe and to take my clothes off as well. As you can imagine, I was horrified and frightened. The situation was out of control, and the fact that it was happening made our future working relationship very difficult, to say nothing of how I felt personally as a woman. I mean, to be assaulted in this way.
Sanders stared at her, trying desperately to control his anger. He heard Fernandez at his ear.
Breathe.
He took a deep breath and let it out slowly. He had not been aware until then that he was holding his breath. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.